for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Attorney General Eric Holder announces his resignation. Pressure mounts on Congress to pass a new authorization for strikes against ISIS. And a White House breach prompts a review of Secret Service protocol. Joining me for the Domestic Hour, the Friday News Roundup, Reed Wilson of The Washington Post, Susan Page of USA Today, and Olivier Knox of Yahoo News. I invite you to be part of the program. You can give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. You can also see the program during this first hour of the Friday News Roundup as we are video streaming the entire hour. And welcome to all of you.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning.
Hi, Diane.
Good to see you. Olivier Knox, Eric Holder resigns. Not entirely unexpected.
Not entirely unexpected. He actually told The New Yorker in January or February of this year that he would stay in office well into 2014, but that obviously set kind of a timetable for him to announce his departure. Not a total surprise. One of President Obama's closest friends, one of his most long-serving advisors. So it wasn't a surprise, but it was still a bit of a blow to a president who's still trying to get his second term back on its feet.
And Susan, you served on a media committee with the Department of Justice.
You know, that one of the things that Eric Holder has dealt with is really alarm among a lot of journalists over the Department of Justice practices toward journalists. This administration has launched more leak investigations than all previous administrations put together. James Risen from The New York Times still has the threat of going to jail for his refusal to name his source on a story he did regarding Iran. And one of the things that, in the wake of all this criticism, one of the things that Eric Holder did was form a group of about eight journalists to meet with him and talk about these issues. We don't have any power, but I think it's while I disagree with some of the practices the Justice Department has taken toward journalists, I appreciate the fact that he was willing to convene this group. We've been meeting at the Justice Department with him and with other officials and to try to address some of the concerns.
How many of you?
There are about eight journalists on this committee and two media lawyers.
Mm-hmm. And Reed Wilson, why now? There's some talk he had health problems.
Yeah, apparently his wife, who's a physician, was worried about his a recent health scare. There wasn't a lot of detail about what that would have been. But there's also a political reality, and the political reality is Democrats control the Senate now. They might not control the Senate in 4 months when the next Congress convenes. This gives the White House an opportunity to put forward a new nominee, and the short list is already out, to put forward a new nominee, to hold the necessary confirmation hearings in a lame duck session after the election, and then perhaps to get a vote on the confirmation when Democrats still have the majority.
But is he really going to be able to get a vote? So much controversy.
That's the question. A number of Republicans from the sort of uninfluential, like Senator Ted Cruz, to the uninfluential within the U.S. Senate, like Ted Cruz, to the very influential, like Chuck Grassley, who's the ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee, have questioned whether or not now is the right time for a quick hearing. Some of those Republicans want to see the next Congress deal with an attorney general. There's a bit of an irony here in that so many Republicans on Capitol Hill despise Eric Holder and have voted to hold him in contempt. And when he says he will stay on until his replacement is confirmed, they're now delaying the confirmation of his replacement. So there's a little irony there that they're keeping him on a little longer than they
might
want to.
Who's on a short list, Susan?
Well, we have the conventional wisdom shortlist, which may or not actually reflect what President Obama himself is thinking, but Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts, his second term about to end, I think would definitely be on that list. There are the U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York.
Preet Bharara.
Thank you very much. Is also said to be on the list. You know, this is, and there might be some current members of of the Senate who would be possible. Amy Klobuchar is somebody who has been mentioned as a possibility, although taking any Democratic senator out of the Senate mix might be somewhat dangerous. There is the Attorney General of California, who is
Kamala Harris.
Thank you very much. who is also one of those possibilities. You know, there is speculation that he'll want to choose either a woman or an African American or a racial minority to fill that job. That would be put that person maybe in a position to carry on some of the big initiatives that Eric Holder has done.
Olivier, what is Eric Holder's legacy?
Well, it's a complicated legacy because on the one hand, he took a lot of strides. You know, his model, his idol is Bobby Kennedy, and he took a lot of steps to protect the right to vote, to combat voter ID laws and other ways of limiting voting. But as Susan pointed out, he has a really mixed record on things like civil liberties. The administration's war on the press was fought mostly through his office. And so that was a mixed legacy.
What started that, do you recall?
The war on the press, I would probably date it all the way back to the campaign in terms of the any ill will. But I think that, you know, this is a president who came in with a pretty cold-blooded sense of how to use national security powers. I don't mean that as pejoratively as it sounds, but extremely calculating and someone who actually saw some of these reports as truly dangerous leaks. And, of course, as a Democrat, is under more pressure to do more about it than a Republican might be. Eric Holder took a lot of you've seen the reports now. He's he's in a crossfire now because liberals say he didn't do enough to take on big Wall Street firms at ground zero for the financial crisis. They're talking about the national security apparatus, and conservatives are hitting him over the Fast and Furious gun running investigation, the IRS scandal, and other things which they don't think he did enough to investigate.
You know, that's entirely true, everything that you said. One of the things he did do was tackle even the discussion of the issue of race in America, the question about police practices, the disproportionate sentences and the very long sentences for some nonviolent drug crimes. And, you know, it was like there was a lot of speculation he was going to leave at the end of President Obama's first term. And then he seemed to get kind of a second wind and began to address some of these issues that I think possibly President Obama would like to address, but for a variety of political and policy reasons has trouble tackling in a big way. He's got a lot of other things on his plate. He doesn't really want to be known as a black president because he has other things he wants to address. And that is, I think, going to be a big part of Eric Holder's legacy.
So how likely is it, Reed Wilson, that we are going to get another confirmed attorney general?
I think
before the next election.
I think it's more likely than not. I think that it will be a relatively, especially if some of the people on the short list have been confirmed by the Senate before by very wide margins, whether it's Tom Perez, the Secretary of Labor, Janet Napolitano, the former DHS secretary who's now the president of the University of California system. She's sort of a long shot. A number of U.S. attorneys, Susan mentioned Preet Bharara, but there are a couple others around the country, one in eastern New York, one here in Washington, D.C., who are sort of on that list. You know, these are people who've been confirmed by the Senate before. The Republicans will use these confirmation hearings to bring up a lot of the things that both Susan and Olivia talked about, whether it's Fast and Furious or the Affordable Care Act or anything, essentially anything that has anything to do with the Justice Department. And almost every element of President Obama's policy agenda has something to do with the Justice Department. It will come up in confirmation hearings. Republicans will use that, but at the end of the day, it's extremely unlikely that an attorney general nominee will be blocked.
You know, especially, I mean, it depends in part on who President Obama chooses.
Because
if he chooses someone who is less controversial than Eric Holder, then there may be some incentive on the part of Republicans to get the new attorney general in there, since Holder has said he'll stay on until the new person is confirmed. And the new rules that the Senate is following makes it a little easier to get it done with just Democratic votes, because you don't have the filibuster possibility against this confirmation, right? You only need a majority vote. So I think I think that somebody will get confirmed. And in part, it was shrewd of the administration to make it clear that you don't confirm the new guy. You're stuck with the old guy with whom we've had so many problems.
How high on the list is Deval Patrick?
He took himself out of the running yesterday. He made very clear he's going to go back to the private sector. I mean, I think he'll still get some pressure to play a role, but you know, he very clearly knew this was coming. He's got a long relationship with the president and a long relationship with the attorney general as well. But I wouldn't expect him to be the
final. Hard job to turn down.
Yeah, it is.
I think that's the challenge. When the president puts the offer in your hand, you know, how easy it is to turn down. We also know that Kamala Harris. California Democrats are saying no way because they want her down the line to run for Senate or some other high office or governor. And so they don't want to put her in a position where she might get locked into these bruising battles in Washington, D.C. But it would be really interesting to see. I mean, a lot of these predictions are, I think, rooted in part in our interest in seeing, wow, what would happen if he nominated. I mean, you know, I have a little fantasy that he nominates Bill Clinton, but just purely for the interest, purely for the resulting news story. But I think, you know, I think that the odds on favorite is another dangerous game because this is a president who really likes to surprise us with his picks.
You think?
Oh, yeah.
All right. And there's pressure on Congress in another way, and that is for new authorization for the use of military force. As we began dropping bombs on Syria this week, Reid.
And this is a debate that is likely to happen, likely to dominate the lame duck session. There are, you know, Democrats and Republicans aren't exactly divided down partisan lines on this. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi voted in favor of allowing the president at least some leeway in bombing Syria to begin with. So there aren't really partisan lines here.
Reid Wilson at the Washington Post. He writes the political tip sheet called Reid In. Short break here, and I'll look forward to hearing from you when we come back. And welcome back to our Friday News Roundup of Domestic Issues. This week with Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief with USA Today and a frequent fill-in for me when I am out. And I always thank you for that, Susan.
It's my privilege.
Olivier Knox, Chief Washington Correspondent for Yahoo News. Reid Wilson of the Washington Post. And you can see all of our guests on our video stream by joining our Google Hangout. We've posted the list on Facebook and Twitter. Big security breach at the White House this week. Olivier, what happened?
An Iraq war veteran thought to be mentally ill scaled the North Fence, which is the fence along the White House perimeter on Pennsylvania Avenue, which is closed to automobile traffic, scaled the fence. That happens a lot. What doesn't happen a lot is what happened afterward. They're usually tackled within the first 20 yards or so, and this gentleman got all the way inside the doors of the North Portico, which, if you've ever been a tourist in Washington, is that beautiful colonnade entrance at the top of the White House driveway.
And? then.
Well, and then he was detained.
And then he opened the door and walked
but
in.
But he walked
and
in.
Because as walked in. Now,
who keeps doesn't keep their front door locked?
I understand, but you.
Well, it's the person who doesn't keep their door locked is the person who's got 500 Secret Service agents guarding the door.
Presumably.
And thousands of tourists going through that door as they walk out of the.
Here's what I don't get. I understand that there have been several previous breaks that maybe we haven't heard quite as much about.
Well, I think we usually hear about them. I don't know that we always understand their seriousness. Now, during the break, Olivia was mentioning the one where that guy was driving around a little lost and followed the motorcade carrying the first daughters into the White House, which I think that he was determined not to be somebody who even intended to do this. And yet, what a breach that was.
That was a much, actually, if you talk to people at the service, that's the breach that really freaked everybody out, because that stretch of Pennsylvania Avenue was closed after the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing, and it was closed explicitly because of the possibility that someone would drive a vehicle packed with explosives and do a lot more damage to the White House. So for a vehicle to breach that perimeter was a much more serious breach than this gentleman. As spectacular as his breach was, the vehicle one is the one that really freaked people out.
But, you know, the thing that disturbed me about the breach this time was that this man had had two encounters with the Secret Service before. He had showed up with a hatchet on his belt looking around the White House. They had stopped. They had interrogated him. They let him go. Previously, he had been stopped in a car. It turned out that he had a map with the White House circled. The Secret Service interviewed him. I mean, there were opportunities to identify this man as being disturbed and targeting the president and doing something about it before he climbed the fence.
And many rounds of ammunition found in his car.
I think it was 800 rounds that they found in his car. I mean, this spotlights, once again, an agency that's in real trouble.
Yeah.
The Secret Service has fought back against low morale. They've been battling low morale. They've been battling a number of incidents of serious misbehavior by a number of agents. They are incredibly short-staffed, which means that somebody who joins the agency in, I don't know, Albuquerque because they're from Albuquerque, gets rotated to Washington. They think they're going to go home soon. They never end up getting to go home because there aren't enough officers to rotate in and out. The new director, Julia Pearson, has been on the job for about 18 months now. She has, by all accounts, not been able to turn around the culture. She's a career Secret Service officer herself. She was running before she took over the whole agency. She was running the agency's budget. It has been several years now in which maybe a decade, in which this agency has been facing these serious challenges that they just haven't been able to overcome. And this is another negative mark.
All right. So they're short-staffed. Is that what you're arguing? Because there's not enough money?
Well, there's not enough money, but there's also they've faced cuts. They've also been moved. When the Department of Homeland Security was created, they were taken out of their historical home in the Treasury Department and moved to DHS. That caused a whole layer of new bureaucracy that causes problems among some of the senior officers, but even the junior officers. I mean, they're having to work 6-7 hour days, and there's simply not enough people to do the job that the Secret Service is required
all
to do.
Right. And the other thing are the scandals that have reflected back on them over the past, past year.
I was going to say I can appreciate that they're short-staffed and working long hours, and we know that this is a really difficult and dangerous job. We should acknowledge that. They put their lives on the line to protect public officials. On the other hand, that doesn't go to, like, cavorting with prostitutes when you're on a president trip or getting so drunk in a foreign hotel that you're found passed out in a hallway. Those goes to kind of basic judgment issues that you would not expect to be having.
So what kinds of changes do you expect?
I don't know. Pearson is being called back up to the Hill, to the House Oversight Committee, this next Tuesday to talk about this latest incident. I mean, there is congressional oversight of this, and you've got to assume that President and Mrs. Obama are first on the list of those concerned about how things are going.
Yeah, and of course they happen to luckily be away when this gentleman simply walked in the door. I want to go back, Olivier, to this authorization for the use of military force. Do you expect the Congress to act on this in a lame duck session?
I don't expect them to. John Boehner said in an interview with the New York Times the other day that maybe the better time would be when they come back in January. But as you hear all these calls from folks for a vote, people who say we really should be debating this and voting on it, we really should vote on it. Here's the thing. The War Powers Act of 1973 basically makes it possible for any member of Congress to force a vote on this. So all this posturing about we want to vote, we want to vote, they could actually go right directly to the War Powers Act. They could submit two kinds of resolution, one a declaration of war, the other a declaration requiring the president to withdraw American forces from harm's way. That triggers a calendar under the law that requires committees of jurisdiction to take it up in Congress. And basically, you set up a vote. It happened in the 1990s. So I get a little impatient with some of the folks who get in front of the cameras and say, gosh, we really need to have a vote. Well, member of Congress, you could force one if you wanted to.
So what are you saying, that they are talking out of both sides of their mouth?
Well, I mean, the alternative is that they just don't know what the law says, which I suppose is possible. But it's a delicate balance, obviously, on Capitol Hill, because even though this could basically circumvent the leader's will and in some ways short-circuit the committee process, because it requires all these actions. You don't want to make the leader angry unnecessarily. But if you're going to get before the cameras and say that a vote on this years-long military campaign, uncertain definition of victory and the rest of it, which I think is a worthy argument, then it probably behooves you to look at all the tools in your toolkit and realize that you actually could force a vote.
You know, it's certainly true there are people trying to make politics out of this, right, stunningly, here in Washington as we head into an election year. You know, there's one person I think I would point out as trying to foster a very honest debate about it, and that's Senator Kaine from Virginia, who has stood up and given a series of speeches, including a speech that he gave this week, talking about how important it is to have a vote on this and a debate on this and how dishonest it is to be relying on the use of force authorization that was passed in the wake of the 9/11 attacks to stretch that to cover this. And I would, you know, he's a person who is not only a Democratic senator, former chairman of the DNC, close to President Obama, you know, has a relationship with President Obama. So I guess I would watch him as somebody who is honestly trying to raise some of the serious issues that are raised by the refusal so far of Congress to vote.
At the risk of getting angry emails from sources, which I guess is a foregone conclusion at this point, there's a dividing line on this. Senator Kaine and a few others, Adam Schiff, a Democrat from California, and a few others, were calling for a vote on this before the president said he did not need Congress authorization and wasn't going to ask for it. Okay, that's the dividing line. People, this policy has been telegraphed since mid-June at the latest. The people who were saying from, say, June 19th when the president laid it out, gee, we really should have a vote on it, people like Tim Kaine, people like Adam Schiff and others, those folks have been doing that before it was clear that there would be consequences for that call. So when the president said, I don't need your help, I don't need your authorization, everyone who came out after that, I'm a little bit suspicious.
The interesting part of all this to me is that I think a lot of members of Congress, leaders in Congress, don't really know how to go about this process. They don't know how to set up the debate. You know, this is the first debate like this that we've seen in 10 years, with the only exception being the proposal to bomb Syria last year. That went nowhere after leaders sort of lost control of the debate there. So I'm going to be really interested to see how John Boehner in the House, Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell in the Senate sort of set up the structures of the debate and essentially who the main players are. I don't think anybody has made those decisions yet because both sides are I shouldn't say both sides. There aren't really partisan sides in this. It's just they don't quite know how to go about the process.
They're slightly hamstrung by the fact that typically it's the administration that asks for an authorization to use force. It's not Congress that comes up with it on its own.
All right, to end with less than 6 weeks to go until midterm, what's the overall picture, Reid?
Well, at the moment, as we all know, Republicans need to net 6 seats to pick up the U.S. Senate. There are 7 or 8 Democratic seats that are in serious peril, three of which are probably safe to assume they're definitely going Republican. Of those 5 seats left that are in the middle that are essentially going to decide the majority, Maybe there are even six seats in that category. Republicans are looking better and better. The Republican chances are improving because President Obama's approval rating is so low. The national atmosphere is not getting any better. People are more pessimistic about the economy. People think the economy is worse now than it was in 2008, which, whether or not it's, I mean, it's not in fact the case, but to them, I mean, that sort of informs the average American's vote, and that is not a good thing for the National Party. The other part of this is that the entire landscape of the 2014 midterm elections is being fought on Republican turf. Of those big Senate seats that will determine control of the Senate, Mitt Romney won all of them. And in some cases, he won them by very large margins. President Obama's approval rating is at 31% in Arkansas, where a Democratic senator is running for re-election, 38% in North Carolina, where a Democratic senator is running for re-election. That's a terrible atmosphere to be.
We have an email from Maryland who says, you all seem set on autopilot with your assumption Republicans will take control of the Senate. When I read the polls, I see four pickups at most. How are you coming to your conclusion?
I'm happy to go through the math. So, Republicans need to pick up six. They're going to win West Virginia, South Dakota, and Montana, three Democratic seats that just aren't competitive. Democrats haven't overtly tried to win those seats. Incumbent Democrats in Arkansas and Louisiana, where Senator Mark Pryor and Senator Mary Landrieu are running for re-election, are in very, very deep trouble. Even Democratic strategists will say they are likely to lose. That can change in the next 6 weeks, but they're behind in the polls right now. To me, the entire race, that sixth seat, the 51st Republican seat, comes down to the state of Alaska. And if Senator Mark Begich is able to pull out a win in a very Republican state, and we've seen some polls just in the last 24 hours that show him trailing, then Democrats hold the Senate. But, you know, North Carolina, Colorado, Iowa, Republicans have some really good chances this year.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Susan.
I would just say that Marilyn has a good point, which is that we're still about 6 weeks out.
Yeah.
And that is enough time for something to happen. We've had wave elections. It didn't really become clear, didn't crystallize until the final weeks before the election. The trouble for Democrats is if you have a wave election, it is more likely to be one that favors Republicans and Democrats. But things happen. And so we should always be modest about, as Reid is, I know Reid is, as well, you are, so, about our
you're,
certainty.
You're the only
about
person
things.
Who thinks that, thank you.
But I would say one excellent thing that has happened this year is that finally, at last, Kansas is at the center of the national political debate. That's my home state. Often ignored, here we have a competitive governor's race and a competitive Senate race against a very veteran Republican Senator Pat Roberts. And the independent candidate, Greg Orman, just may win. He would be the first non-Republican to win in Kansas since Herbert Hoover.
How likely.
I think that race is really hard to call. The Republicans have now sent in every troop they have. They've got Bob Dole out there campaigning and Sarah Palin. That's kind of the spectrum of the Republican Party these days. And that may save it for Pat Roberts. But without having taken over that campaign, Pat Roberts, I think, was about to lose.
Just think of how much money has gone into these Senate races.
Well, and in fact, there was a study out this week by the Center for Responsive Politics that said that $228 million
right.
in independent expenditures have been spent so far. That's more than in any election other than 2012. And that's a reflection, really, of this Supreme Court decision that opened the door to all kinds of independent spending.
Right. So President Obama spoke at the UN summit this week. He spoke on climate change. One wonders whether he won hearts and minds. Olivier.
I think you're seeing some evidence that he may have swayed a few hearts and minds. I don't know that there's going to be a groundswell of action on climate change. You know, this is a cause that he's been talking about since he was inaugurated. And he's taken a lot more steps in the last couple of years via executive order because, of course, everything's locked up in Congress. I think at the UN, I think what he's getting is he's getting some commitments from like-minded leaders. But among the big challenges are, of course, trying to get very large, growing, developing economies like China and like India to sign on to this sort of thing. I mean, these are steps that would likely, at least in the short term, slow down their growth.
Who did not send their presidents to that UN summit?
Well, the president's meeting is going to be meeting shortly with the Prime Minister Modi of India. So they'll have a chance to discuss this problem and others face to face. But, you know, everyone is looking to the United States to lead on this, even though the United States' share of carbon emissions has dropped relative to other economies.
Well, in fact, it greatly strengthened, I think, the president's hand in his speech that he was able to point to his own executive initiative that is aimed at cutting carbon emissions here by 17% by 2020. You know, previously he's had to talk about this as I'm going to push this in Congress. You know, this time, this year, he finally gave up on that and did some action through the Environmental Protection Agency. And that gave him something to say, we're taking this step. He promised to put out another plan next year that will go even further. And that gave him, that gave the United States the credibility to lecture China, for instance.
Susan Page of USA Today. And we're going to take a short break here, but if you're joining us, you can also watch live on Google Hangout. We posted the list on Facebook and Twitter. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Zurich, providing risk management and insurance solutions for those who truly love their business. Learn more at zurichna.com. By Progressive Insurance, with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. By TiVo, delivering cable TV, on-demand, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus from a single device. Learn more at TiVo.com. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. U.S.-led airstrikes hit Syrian oil refineries held by ISIS. At the UN, President Obama calls for global unity in the fight against Islamic extremism. And India becomes the first Asian nation to reach Mars. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. It's time to open the phones. Questions, comments from you, our listeners. You're always a part of this program. First to William in Jacksonville, Florida. You're on the air.
Hey, Diane. Glad to see you're doing well.
Thank you.
Good to see your show every day.
Thank you, sir.
And I just wanted to make a comment about Mr. Holder.
Sure.
I think he was one of the best attorney generals we had. He done a lot for bringing attention to the long jail sentence for minorities. I also wanted to thank him and look forward, hope that he has a great future. And I was sorry about our congressmen and senators being so aggressive towards the achievements that he tried to make. That's
well, I thank you for calling. I hope he's listening and has heard your comments. Here's an email from Michael, who says, I was surprised by Holder's announcement to resign. Given the Ferguson case pending, the new investigation in Dayton with John Crawford, Holder's focus on civil rights is happening at what seems like a turning point on the issue. What does the panel think might happen to this focus when Attorney General Holder is replaced? Reed Wilson.
Well, I think it depends on who the Attorney General is. Let me say that a different way. The focus will remain the same, whether or not the prominence is given, whether or not it's talked about as openly and aggressively as Eric Holder talked about problems of race in America remains. I think that's up to the actual nominee. Remember, just a few weeks into his tenure as Attorney General back in February 2009. He said Americans are sort of cowardly when it comes to race. He wasn't wrong.
I think also, though, if you talk to anybody at the White House or in the Justice Department, what they'll tell you is one of his legacy achievements is revitalizing the civil rights division of the department and really putting in a functioning infrastructure, a high-performing infrastructure where it was really in shambles before. So I think that what's going to happen is even if he's not at the helm, this is a priority for this president, which is important. And Holder's leaving behind a really revitalized civil rights division that will carry on the work, even if he's not at the helm.
All right. To Rhonda in Murphy, Texas. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you.
Sure.
I am very concerned about the Secret Service and their lack of protection of the commander-in-chief. I can't understand how they were so lax in letting someone get across. Since, you know, I think we are so up in arms about if we are, is because there was a tourist that took video of it, and perhaps these things that happened before, but we could not see it with our own eyes. I think had it, you know, we have policemen all across this country who are shooting down citizens who are not charging for the White House. So I just think it represents a larger disrespect for the president and for the people that he has chosen, you know, to represent him and his administration. I think the vitriol that has been created by the Republicans, by the conservatives in the country, have really created like a funk in the country, you know, for this president and for what he has tried to do. It just kind of pains me as an American to just hear the constant vitriol, you know, no matter what he does, who he chooses.
All right, Susan.
You know, I think Rhonda makes a good point that the vitriol that's been directed at President Obama from the beginning has, I'm sure, raised the threat level against him. I'm sure it creates all kinds of threats that we don't know about that the Secret Service has to deal with and must deal with, right? Because they're supposed to protect him. You know, there's not really a thought that they should have shot this man as he ran toward the front door. The first family had left. He didn't have a backpack that could have been filled with explosives. However, they do have dogs there that are trained to chase and bring down.
So where were they?
And that's a question that I think we are going to see raised at the congressional hearing on Tuesday.
Interesting.
I think the director of the Secret Service praised the agents involved for not shooting the man, said that showed restraint. But there is a lot of criticism for not releasing the dogs.
You know, at the same time, here you have the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI telling law enforcement to be on the lookout for the lone wolf terrorist threat. What's the concern here? How great should our fear be?
Well, the lone wolf terrorist threat is something that's been of concern for years. The current lone wolf terrorist threat is tied a little bit more closely to the conflict in Syria. You know, for months now, I'm sure every person listening to this program has heard senior American officials say that about 100 Americans went to Syria to fight with groups like the Islamic State or the Al-Qaeda-linked al-Nusra Front. They obviously have their passports. They could conceivably come back to the United States and carry out attacks. What we have, though, in this past week is a little more clarity on that figure. First, at the FBI, James Comey has said now that it's about 20 to 30 who are actually fighting in Syria, that 100 refers to American citizens going or trying to go to Syria. So that's a bit of a climb down. But they are concerned about lone wolf attacks. Like because those are the hardest ones to stop. Someone who's been radicalized by events around the world, someone who's not taking direct orders from extremist leaders, is much harder. There's no communication to intercept. There's very little planning to disrupt sometimes. And so that's what they're really worried about.
And what about this comment from the Iraqi president who said, you know, Europe or the U.S. about to be hit?
So the new Iraqi prime minister suggested in an interview this week that there may be a terrorist plot against subway systems in New York and Paris. James Comey, the director of the FBI, was very clear yesterday. He said, we do not have that intelligence. This is apparently not the first time that somebody in Iraq's government has said we have intelligence and the U.S. has said, no, you don't. So it's not clear. One interesting thing, by the way, as we go after this new group in Syria and Iraq, the Khorasan group, American officials have said that I'm forgetting the exact parsing of their words and the exact sort of phrasing is important, but they have said that there is an imminent threat, but imminent doesn't necessarily mean tomorrow or next week or even that there are actual plans in the works. It's just that there is a group that is really trying to attack us. They have put together the resources they need to get the initial plans off the ground. However, that doesn't mean that they're coming at the specific targets within the U.S. So
okay.
The administration's very careful about how they phrase those things.
I'm going to take you on to another topic involving finances and new rules regarding tax inversion. Corporate inversions that allow large corporations to somehow diminish or even remove taxes paid to the federal government. Susan.
And this has been something that's really outraged a lot of Americans, the idea that American companies merge with a foreign company, and one of the big purposes is to evade U.S. taxes by doing so. So there's people in Congress are up in arms about it, but Congress has been unable to actually do anything about it. They seem paralyzed even on issues on which there is broad agreement. So this week we had the Treasury Secretary, Jacob Lew, announce rules doing what you could do by executive action to make it less profitable, less beneficial to American companies to do this.
So are these rules going to work?
Well, people who know more about this topic than I do say that they'll do something but not everything, and that it's sort of like the issue of global warming. There are some things you can do by executive action, but to take the most far-reaching steps that would do the most to make this not something attractive to U.S. companies would take an action of Congress.
All right. Let's go to, Eric in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Diane.
Sure.
I can't for the life of me figure out why it is that the Democrats are distancing themselves in the midterm elections, why some of the Democratic candidates are trying to distance themselves from Obama. Whatever metrics you use to judge by how things are going in the United States, he's doing well. If you're in the top 50% economically in America, you're going like gangbusters. If you're in the bottom 50%, he's doing everything he can. He's trying to preserve the Affordable Care Act. He's trying to raise the minimum wage, close loopholes on the tax loopholes on the wealthy, and lower the cost of education. So no matter what strata you're in economically, he's either doing a good job or trying to do the right thing. And from foreign policy, he's got a lot of fires that I think he's doing a very good job in putting out.
Sounds as though you're a great supporter of President Obama, Susan.
You know, Eric, we have the White House on line two. They'd like to get your last name and your phone number. Because this is an argument people at the White House would make, but it
of
is
course.
Not an argument that is working well in the states where we have the most competitive races.
I think a lot of these folks in these tough Senate races are distancing themselves from the president because they, by themselves, without the president on the ballot, cannot recreate the coalition that swept him into office in 2008, 6 years ago, the length of a senator's term.
All right, to Joanna in Sutton, New Hampshire. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Diane. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'm absolutely on board with the previous caller. I love what he had to say because I am truly dumbfounded that there are any close House or Senate races going on. It's hard to believe that anyone would vote Republican. And I feel like from day one, with Obama's presidency, the Republicans have been obstructionists to any positive progress for this country, especially when it comes to the economy and the environment. And I really, truly believe, and I've talked to people in my area, and we think what it comes down to is there's prejudice going on, and they just cannot accept that there's an African American as a president.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, they impeached the last guy, the last Democrat who was in office. We're clearly in an atmosphere in the U.S. where there are two Americas living side by side. One that absolutely loves everything this president has done, and one that thinks that everything he's done is ruining the country. And let me tell you, they don't talk to each other. They don't read the same newspapers or watch the same television shows. Or there are a lot of consumer studies that suggest they don't even drink the same beer. So we're sort of segregating ourselves along ideological lines, physically, mentally, all around the country, and that's a really disturbing trend.
Including in New Hampshire, where Joanne was calling from. I mean, there's a close Senate race in New Hampshire, a race that we didn't think, I think, initially was going to be as close, with Jeanne Shaheen running for re-election and Scott Brown running for the Senate from a different state this time. And that is a race that I think would have to be on the list of races that are hard to call at this point.
And to the caller's point, you know, I mean, the wages have remained fairly stagnant for decades. A lot of the gains that you see in the headlines don't actually trickle down to most Americans. A lot of Americans know someone who's been out of work for a long time. A lot of Americans know someone who fought overseas for this country, came back, and was not treated particularly well by the VA that provides their health care. People aren't feeling the good news as much as they're feeling the bad news. And it's not necessarily a partisan issue at all. It could just be a reflection of that.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Kate. The New York Times included Jennifer Granholm, former Michigan governor, in the list of possible nominees to replace Eric Holder. How likely a candidate is she, and could she get through a Republican House? Susan.
I think she is not a likely candidate. I was actually surprised to see her name in the New York Times story this morning, because she's been a pretty partisan figure since she left office. And it seems to me that she would create problems that the White House doesn't need in this confirmation fight.
And another question on that line from Mark, who says, I'm glad to hear Governor Deval Patrick has taken his name out of the running for attorney general. A few months ago, President Obama made a remark that the governor would make a great running mate for any presidential contender on the Democratic side. I'd love to see him as a vice president, perhaps even a president someday.
Well, he has ruled out being an attorney general. He has not ruled out running for president at some time in the future. I would point out that his consultant, his sort of main political advisor, is a guy named David Axelrod, who had something to do with President Obama getting elected in the first place. And I believe his first gubernatorial campaign was managed by David Plouffe, who was President Obama's campaign manager the first time around, too. But back to the AG thing for a second, we haven't actually mentioned, I think, the person that consensus would suggest is the leading candidate to replace Eric Holder, and that's Donald Verrilli, the Solicitor General of the United States, the guy who argued in favor of the Affordable Care Act in front of the Supreme Court. A lot of early suspects believe that he's the front runner.
How easy would confirmation be for him?
The Solicitor General is confirmed, isn't it? Isn't he? I believe he is.
Think
I believe
he's
the
already...
Solicitor General is a confirmed position. I'm not 100% certain on that, but if it is, then he's been confirmed before.
I think he would be a classic example of what Reed was talking about earlier, about this confirmation process being essentially a referendum on everything that the Justice Department touches. And he would be tied quite closely. He argued successfully in favor of Obamacare's constitutionality. I think there's no way that Republicans would shy away from revisiting that discussion.
All right. It looks as though we got another long few months ahead. And the Obama administration making a shift in its nuclear strategy, spending billions of dollars to modernize U.S. nuclear facilities.
You know, this was something I wasn't really aware of until I read a story in the New York Times this week by William Broad and David Sanger. David Sanger, of course, a friend of the Diane Rehm Show, often on the second hour of the news roundup. And it talked about the fact that the president, that this administration has embarked on a large-scale modernization for our nuclear weapons arsenal, originally with the idea that this would help facilitate reducing nuclear arms around the world. It helped negotiations to reduce those levels. It hasn't worked that way. We're modernizing our nuclear arsenal for a variety of geostrategic and other reasons. Negotiating real reductions in nuclear weaponry haven't worked. So we're going to have a bigger, we're going to have a more modern nuclear stores, and it's going to be easier for a future president who wants to increase the levels of nuclear arms to do so.
Susan Page of USA Today. Olivier Knox of Yahoo News, Reed Wilson of The Washington Post. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend, everybody, and thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from C.